So now that I'm looking at that title, I realize it's really horrible, so I won't dwell on it too much. So let me give you a little bit of the motivation that I have behind this this work. One complaint I've always had when it came to audio is that audio models always use a lot of user nudging. You sort of have to always have all these constraints that you put in. Oh, I want harmonic sounds, or the noise has to be stationary. There's always a lot of contribution from the user. And as somebody who loves statistics, I'm sort of slightly allergic to that idea. I don't want myself to input a lot of information to a system. I want a system to learn that information somehow. The other thing that motivates me a lot is that when we see a lot of work being done in audio, we always have this nth term in the end, plus nt, and that basically has to be any kind of interference. And of course, because we're not that comfortable with math, we assume it's a Gaussian, it makes life easy, but of course if you have two people speaking at the same time, the second person is not going to be just a Gaussian signal, it's something much more complicated. So a lot of the work on audio doesn't really carry well to mixtures. And the third motivating point is that, especially nowadays, sort of the Google experiment is one example of that. When you have a lot of data, you can have some very, very simple, very, very stupid algorithms, and they outperform very complicated systems, which is sort of a very humbling experience. So these are the things I want you to keep in mind during this talk, and there's going to be a fourth point, which is also very important, but that's going to come later. The first observation I'm going to make is that, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of the fun stuff you can do with audio has to do with timbre. That's going to be the sound quality. So if you want to do classification, separation, or fool around with sound and transform it in all sorts of fun ways, what you really care about is the magnitude spectrum, because so it happens our ear likes to detect that much more than, say, phase. So I'm only going to be talking about that domain for now. The other observation I'm going to make is that if we normalize spectra, it doesn't really change things. If I speak twice as loud, I'm still going to be saying the same thing. It's not going to make a difference. So the presentation I'm going to be using throughout this talk is that, let's see the pointer, and I hope the people in the back can see a little bit of that. Whenever you see a sort of an uppercase letter that has a little hat on it, that means it's a spectrum that's normalized. So basically we divide it by the sum of all its elements. It's a magnitude spectrum normalized. So it's basically sums to one. What that means is that it starts entering a strange space because it cannot occupy the entire space of spectra. It's going to be basically lying on a simplex. It's going to be a subspace of the overall spectrum space. And here's what that looks like. Let's assume we have a spectrum that only has three frequencies. The way we can represent it, if we know that it's normalized, is with a three simplex, which is shown here. Each vertex of the simplex is going to correspond to a frequency. So we have on the lower left the low frequency. On the top we have our middle frequency. On the lower right we have our high frequency. So within that simplex, we can represent any kind of spectrum that has only three frequencies, assuming we don't care about amplitude. So, for example, all the low-frequency sounds are going to end up in this region. All the high-frequency sounds will be in this region. Any point around the middle is going to be this wideband component that's using all of the frequencies at the same time. So it's a very sort of simple mixing model. The contrast is not great, but we'll move on. So let's talk about a very, very basic sound model based on that idea. On that sort of representation. So I can go out, record 5 hours of speech of somebody speaking, and then every time I have a new recording of that person, what I can do is basically go through the normalized spectra of the new recording. So for example, let's say we pick this spectrum over here, and what I can do is a simple matching, try to figure out which spectrum out of all the training data is the closest to it. So it's a simple nearest neighbor operation. I'm just trying to find the spectrum that has temporally the same sort of look to it. So there's nothing special about doing something like that. Just to give you an example to get oriented, that's what the input was. Do we have sound? We have sound. Here's the input.
Necessary retouching was put on at once.
And here's what it ends up being approximated if we just swap all the spectra with the closest looking spectrum from the training data.
Necessary retouching was put on at once.
It's not a good representation, but it's sort of getting the gist of it. What happens in sort of this geometry that we're thinking about, it sort of looks like this. We're going to have the red points, say, being our training data. We're being given some blue points, which are the spectra of the sound we're trying to analyze. We're always trying to find what's the closest point to the point I'm observing right now, and I'm going to swap that in my representation. So there's nothing super special here. There's one point I want to make. This is not a Euclidean space because we have to be constrained in that simplex. Things get a little funny. So we can't really use Euclidean distance. It's going to ignore a lot of the sort of properties of that space which make it unique. And I won't dwell too much on the details. But basically, if you're working on a simplex, you can't assume anything's Gaussian. You have to assume you have something like a Dirichlet distribution. And what that means is that the proper distance measure in that space is going to be the cross entropy between the spectra. So when we're doing that nearest neighbor search, we're looking at the cross entropy between the normalized spectra, not something that, like the L2 distance. So the whole point of this talk, though, is to analyze mixtures because we don't want to have the plus N of T term. Here's how we're going to start with this. I'm going to make a small assumption to begin with. Whenever you have a mixture of two sounds, and here we have sort of an adding operation, the magnitude spectrogram of that mixture, I'm going to assume is going to be equal to the magnitude spectrograms of the individual sounds had we been able to observe them on their own. This is not exactly correct because there's a little nonlinearity by taking the magnitude, but on average, it's a fine assumption. The other thing is that mixing is not necessarily something, a process that's sort of Markovian in any way, so we can just look at one vector at any point in time in that mixture. So what we're doing here is that we're saying that this particular spectrum that we're observing of the mixture is going to be a sum of the corresponding spectra of the original sources at that at the same time. So sort of a very simple idea. And here's what happens when you look at this statement in the space that we're in. We're going to have, again, a sort of three-frequency simplex. We'll be observing a point which is a mixture between our two sources, and that point will have to lie on the subspace that connects the two points of the spectra that went in to create that mixture. So in the previous example, we're going to have these two spectra, which were what the clean sounds were like. Those are going to be represented by these two points. Any point, any spectrum that lies on this subspace between those two points would be a plausible blend of these two spectra. And then how far you are along that line tells you how much of this spectrum is contributing to this. So now that we have this model, we can have a slightly sort of updated version of the nearest neighbor's idea. Now what's going to happen is that I'm going to observe a mixture of sounds, and that's the only thing I'm going to have. I don't know what the original sounds are exactly. I can go to my database and say, well, it looks like in this mixture I have somebody speaking and a whole bunch of chirping birds. So I can get a gigabyte of speech, I can get a gigabyte of chirping birds, it's no big deal nowadays. And what I have to do is that for every spectrum that I'm observing in the mixture, I'm going to try to find one spectrum from the speech database and one spectrum from the sort of chirping bird database that would combine well together in order to approximate what I'm observing. So it becomes this humongous search. And the assumption is going to be that if I do that and I find these two spectra, those would be fair approximations of the spectra that I haven't observed of the original clean sources. What that means, again, in the space that we're in, is that if you're going to have a frequency simplex, a spectrum simplex, there's going to be a subspace where you have, say, the red source because it has this particular timbral characteristics. There's going to be a sort of neighborhood or a subspace that has the blue source. I'm going to try to find all the lines that connect a blue point and a red point and try to figure out which is the one that passes the closest to any of the of my mixture spectra. At this point, you're probably thinking you must be nuts because this is a horrible search problem. Just to give you some numbers, if you have 10 minutes of training data, which is not a lot of data, we're talking about 75,000 spectra per source. And of course, these are something like 2,000 dimensions. 10-second mixture is going to be about 1,200 spectra. That boils down to about 5.5 billion searches for every spectrum of our input. So it's not going to happen if you wait for it that way. But there's a way to actually relax the problem, make it more of a continuous optimization problem. I won't get much to the details because it's extremely boring. The way I'm going to sort of briefly describe it is that we're going to try to basically use all of our training data as being this huge, huge basis set. So every spectrum of our training data will end up being a basis vector. We could sort of concatenate all of that data together, and our goal is to find how to combine all this overcomplete basis in such a way that I'm only using one spectrum from each of the two sources. And if I state it that way, it sounds like a sparse coding problem. It's not particularly hard to solve, so I won't dwell on it too much. And it's an approximate solution, but it's a lot faster. So here's an example of how this thing behaves when you have mixtures. We have two original sounds at the top, and these are the sounds I never get to observe. So just to play one of them.
The museum hires musicians every evening.
So timid stuff, you've all heard of it. And then I have a mixture of two speakers. I also have a lot of training data of these two particular speakers. Now what I can do is do this huge search or optimization, try to approximate every spectrum of the mixture as a superposition of any two spectra from those two speaker databases. If I do that, I can reconstruct the two sources, and here's, for example, one of them.
The museum hires musicians every evening.
Now, here's the thing. I see a lot of familiar faces, and you're probably thinking, what the hell? You just saw the paper 2 days ago, and it sounded so much better. What's the point of doing this? And this is going to be my my fourth point. The whole point of this representation is that we don't necessarily want to separate sounds. I can't for the life of me think why anybody would want to separate the sound, because the reason why you want to separate the sound is because you want to do speech recognition, or you want to do pitch detection. You want to do something afterwards. Separation by itself, it's kind of useless. In fact, there's no evidence that we do it ourselves. So the whole point of this representation is that we have a very nice semantic way of describing the mixtures by saying that we have these two clean spectra that come together to approximate our mixture, gives us the ability to do a lot more smart processing because that spectra will carry some semantic information with it. So here's one quick example. Suppose that we have a mixture of two instruments playing music, which is the one up here, and then I have some training data of those two instruments isolated. It's very easy for me to use a pitch tracker and pitch tag all of the spectra in the training data. So that means that every spectrum that I have there is going to be associated with a pitch value. If I do this kind of decomposition, I'm basically going to be explaining every spectrum in the mixture as a superposition of two spectra from my training data. And that data will have a pitch label added to it. So that means at that point, I know exactly what are the two pitches that are sounding for that particular time in the mixture. And what's nice about it is that if we sort of did experiments starting from doing a solo instrument, so basically just doing a nearest neighbor search, all the way up to having five instruments playing, they were all woodwind instruments at the same time, and sort of here are the results in terms of error and standard deviation in hertz, and you can see that we sort of go from an error of about 4 hertz, average error 4 hertz for the solo case, up to 42 hertz when we have five instruments playing. So that's not something we could do if we had if we just started with a monophonic pitch tracking algorithm. Because we're using this way of decomposing mixtures in terms of things that we can already have labeled, we get this extra ability to get sort of extra labels for the mixtures. Another example of that is phonetic tagging. If I have a mixture of two sounds, of two speakers, and then I can associate that with spectra from their clean recordings, I also have a lot of labels that come with that spectra. I know what phoneme corresponds to that spectrum, and I can maybe do some emotion recognition and know what the emotional state is. I know what speaker that was. I can know what pitch that speaker was speaking at. And what happens is that we only see a very mild degradation when we try to analyze mixtures. So in this case, just some numbers. Simple numbers, for a one speaker, if you just do a nearest neighbor search and a little bit of smoothing, we can get a phoneme error of 45%. Once you have two speakers, you get a phoneme error of 54%, which is a fairly mild sort of increase in the error, even though the problem is considerably harder. And we get about 10% or 8% worse results every time you add a new speaker. So we're gracefully dealing with the mixture case. So to wrap this up, this is just a simple geometric look to sort of consider mixtures. The point I'm trying to make is that you really have to incorporate the idea that sounds mix into a model. You can't just say, well, I'm going to have this clean model, and then hopefully we'll figure out a way to deal with extra sources. So this is a model that starts with the idea that things are going to be mixed together. We really care about... Great. Now you know my schedule. Good. The whole idea of recomposing mixtures based on lots of data is sort of an interesting concept that we see a lot of the computer vision literature. We see it a lot in the text mining literature. We don't really see it that much in the audio space. If you have a lot and lots of recordings, you should be able to explain pretty much everything that comes in. My dream is that at some point our speech databases are going to be so big, you'll just do a nearest search, neighbor search on a sentence, and it'll give you the sentence. You don't have to do all this fancy processing. It's already been done on text, right? If I search for a question on Google, somebody has already asked that. So it's only a matter of time until we do it for speech. And the other thing is that thinking about separation is really a moot point. There's really something else we have to do after separation, and if there's any message I can leave you with, is that being able to analyze mixtures in some smart way is about figuring out what's in the mixture, not necessarily how to extract that information out of it. So I think I'm almost out of time, so I'll stop here. Thank you.
Yes. Thanks, Paris. We got time for some questions.
Hi. Hello. Hello. Okay. One side comment. Some of us who like music actually do want to separate the sounds because we're interested in remixing. I'm just going to mention that.
Okay. And my answer to that is that if you want to remix it, then you just want to remix the music. You don't want to extract the source because you're going to put it back in the mix.
We could talk about upmixing offline. The other thing I just wanted to ask was you made this provocative statement, you can't use Euclidean distance.
Yep.
And then a few slides later you said, but I'm going to use the L2 norm. So
did I say that?
I could have sworn you did.
If I did, it was a mistake.
Maybe I misunderstood. Maybe I misunderstood. Didn't you say you could use the L2 norm to do something to enforce sparsity?
Ah, yes, that.
Okay, so I was just curious what that meant.
Let me find the slide. So whenever we talk about sparsity, what we want to do is optimize the L1 norm of a signal, and that's what the compressive literature is about. It turns out that we're dealing with normalized spectra. They already sum to 1. There's no way I can optimize the L1 norm because it's a non-negative bunch of numbers that sum to 1. It's always going to be 1. It's sort of screwed if you try to optimize that. Because those numbers are going to be between 0 and 1, the closer they are to 0, the square is going to be a smaller number. So by optimizing the L2 norm of a normalized vector that sums to 1, then essentially you're enforcing sparsity because you're saying I want all of the elements to be really, really close to 0, and you're only going to have to leave one of them be a sort of a loud one. That makes sense?
Hi. The two-speaker example that you played, it was artificially made by adding the two signals. I'm just curious how this actually works with real signals where you have reverberation which smears the speaker's signals in time.
Yes. And if you have a long echoes or a big reverberation, it's not a big deal because the echoes of the reverberation are going to be spectra that correspond to some of the previous utterances of the speakers. And that's easy to incorporate in the model. So it's sort of resistant to that. The only place where you get into trouble is if you have very strange phase effects in the reverberation that actually changes the spectrum of a sound. So if you sort of in a bathroom and you have this very ugly echo that's very short and it creates a notch or a resonance in your spectrum, that's going to bias your testing data to be very different from the training data. And the fit is not going to be as good. But as long as the spectral character stays the same, reverberation is not a big deal.
I go? Yeah, so thank you. Very good talk. So I have a question about the representation of the data. So it seems that we need a hell of a lot of data to represent the source.
Yeah.
And you introduce sparsity when you do the search. Seems that the audio data lands in kind of a manifold. So if it's landing in a manifold, it seems that we don't need a lot of data to represent the data itself.
Yeah.
So do you think like introduce sparsity to representation will help us decrease the training?
You need a lot of data in order to properly represent the manifold that every source is lying in. And that's the only reason. And it sort of becomes a very similar problem to supervised learning, where if your data is decent and it can represent your input, then you're fine. And that could mean that you only have a dozen data points, or it could mean you need 5 million data points. So likewise, in this case, if you're dealing with simple sources, there's not too much variation, then you can get away with a little data. If you want to do something that's very, if you want to model everybody's voice at all different pitches and all different phonemes of all sorts of languages, then obviously you need to have a pretty good representation of all the possible cases, and it makes the database pretty huge.
Yeah, Paris, my comment, I guess, just touches off on what you were saying. I mean, I guess we've seen throughout these talks, we've seen a lot of modeling and different ways of modeling the sounds. And I was wondering what your philosophy is, maybe, because you went over it maybe a bit quickly, because you said you've got a mixture and you're going to take two examples or many examples of those two. So it's like you know the components of the mixture already, and then you figure out how they put together. And so what you were saying, at the end, if you have a more complicated situation, or maybe you don't know what the components are, or if it's a more complicated and the database size grows, you were showing earlier the search can grow very big, and you've done some clever stuff to make the search small. What is your philosophy on the overall
The overall dream is that eventually you have a database that has pretty much every sound ever played, and you're going to do a search over that, and chances are that was some whatever you're analyzing has been repeated in the past. So you know that's what we're driving at. One case where sort of one defense point I can use is that in the quintet example here, even when I had a solo recording, I basically had recordings of five instruments, and I had to pick this one spectrum that was closest. In the duet, again, I had the five instruments. I had to pick only two of them. So yes, I did know what instruments were in there, and they were part of the database. But I sort of think of this more of as a logistic problem in that, you know, I had to get some data. You know, ultimately, you just want to have this humongous database that has everything, and pick through that.